to at least try to bring it up out of the philosophical, we see some of this, some of the purists on both sides fighting right now, so that you have the tribal groups, the United Tribes, who are working, and you have the AFN and the corporations who have a corporate viewpoint. They're fighting at that level. We see that there definitely is a larger communal body, a corporate body of tribal interests in traditional lands, and it doesn't have a way to express itself in ANCSCA. It is, tribes are not corporate shareholders. They have no special provision in ANCSCA that says that they are able to comment on what a corporation does. Instead, the only people who have the rights are individual shareholders. But individual shareholders don't, in and of themselves, speak for a tribe. A tribe, by definition, has a body of its own, and it has its own viewpoint. And it limits even its own members. Now, it's easy to get confused because there are some commonalities between a tribal body and a corporate body. They hold derivative rights to property. For instance, shareholders don't own the assets in a corporation. They only have the right to vote. They do have the right to the assets ultimately if there's a liquidation or if there's a distribution of those assets, as does a tribal member. If a tribe liquidates, there are special federal laws, and if a tribe, I suppose, ever traditionally liquidated, they might also have a right to a portion of those assets, but it would have to be under tribal law. Otherwise, they do hold a derivative title. The tribe is the one who has the property, and the individual members are able to enjoy in the distributions of that property and have certain rights to use it if the tribe allows. So there are certain corporate aspects of the two concepts that are similar, so that the idea of communal property and the private property as expressed in corporations law, there are some similarities. So it may be a very appropriate vehicle to use. At this point, I don't say yes or no. The focus of the discussion now and to continue is to try to look at what it is, where we came from, and why it is we need a special period of time to consider where it is that we're going. And when we do decide where it is that we're going, what kind of components do you look at to make a decision on what it is that you want to do? If I have a concern right now, and I like the effort that the AFN is making and the natives as a whole are making in the resolutions, what my concern is that in this move to try to determine our own destinies, that we reduce the scope of our options and don't consider what it is and why it is that we want something to change. It's very easy to look at the end results and hire attorneys like myself to go ahead and work on fancy little proposals for solutions. But in order to get there, you've got to try to consider what it is, what are the components of your decision. Yes, I was on a corporate board myself. I advise many corporations, so I know the technical problems you have to live with day to day. But I think that you're not going to get real, firm, satisfactory, long-term solutions unless you do look at some of these other issues that aren't considered in day-to-day corporate management. What it is that causes a conflict in me and you, the other native shareholder. I own private property, but then again, I'm a tribal member. My tribe doesn't happen to own property right now. A corporation does. I now have the right, derivatively, to determine what happens with that property. I've got conflict in myself that
part of the would become mingled with the lands of the privately held in lands in Alaska generally, and that there would be nothing distinctive after 1991 about Native corporations. They would just be corporations with some Native shareholders, some non-Native shareholders, and that was clearly the intention. Now, no other settlement that I'm aware of, either before or since, adopted that particular method of settling the claim. And we're in a situation where, as far as I can tell, and no one here is disputing it, as far as I can tell, Native people in Alaska are saying, well, we don't want that outcome. We don't want nature to take its course. We don't want to see the land that we hold, that we always held in common, and that is now held by corporations. We don't want to see that land fall into non-Native hands. That is the theme of what I've been hearing in the villages. They feel that land should be passed on from one generation to the next. Yet, as Charlie Johnson says, and I thought the way he put it sums up the dilemma, Bart adverted to this, there is an expectation of individual benefit. People out there are holding shares. Some of them, like Bart, who's a shareholder of Siri and Tionic, I guess, he's been getting dividends. I don't know how much, but a lot of those places, people haven't been getting dividends. And like human beings everywhere, they can't help thinking that maybe in 1991, these shares will be worth something, and I will finally get something out of this claim, because the idea of cash has always been regarded as part of this claim. And some people who didn't get any dividends from their regional corporation or their village corporation are, I think, quite legitimately on one side of their, with one half of their minds, thinking it'd be nice to get some money out of this thing, because I was supposed to get some money and then I never did. And whether it's Congress that's responsible or the guys running the corporations who didn't earn the profits that they were supposed to and so didn't pay the dividends and I didn't get any money, there's that feeling. And yet, I think the dominant feeling, even among those people who feel that sense of grievance, that I should have got something out of this, and maybe in 1991 I will, if you say to them, and this is the discussion that's gone on at the village hearings that I've held, other Native people have said, but if you sell your shares, then outsiders will come in, they'll own this land, it won't be ours anymore. Surely you wouldn't sell your shares then. They say, okay, I wouldn't sell my shares, now when you put it that way. And yet, again and again, people say, I don't think I should sell my shares, I think it'd be a bad thing if we all sold, and yet, faced with a temptation, I might do that. And of course, all of us in life can agree on some abstract principle that we shouldn't do such and such, and yet in certain circumstances we might find that as individuals we would do that very thing. And so Congress has set up this dilemma, and it's something that nobody else has really faced in quite this form. Now I've got all these experts here, the attorneys, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't think anybody's ever had to wrestle with anything quite like this. And
I'd like to just address it in one way, although even though I'm an attorney, I'm not adequate to deal with this question, and that is the extent to which it is a correct view that you've expressed as to what Congress had in mind after 1991, what would happen as the nature of the corporation evolved. I think that there are a lot of corporations in American society that are basically either closely held or family nature corporations, or have other qualities, even though they may have aspects of wide ownership, even public ownership, where resolutions have had to be developed that preserve cultural integrity and yet allow some economic investment from the outside. Let me just point to a couple. One is the Getty Getty family and the planning of its assets, and the culmination in the Getty Foundation and the Getty Museum.
Make an offer. offer to their own shareholders to buy back shares is one that people should think very hard about, because you would wind up with what we have in Canada in a slightly different form, status and non-state of status Indians, through a series of legislative measures. We have two classes of Indians in Canada. Some are entitled to benefits under treaties. Others have lost that right. And some of them lost it by selling out. I won't explain how that occurred. It's just too complicated. But I can see people here heading down that same road. I only have gone through this exercise to show how every time we think we're emerging from the thicket, we find there's some other abyss waiting for us to fall into. And I don't know who thought all this up back in 1971, but it's kind of marvelous in a way. Because it really does confront people with a series of dilemmas. Rosita pointed out something that I think should not be overlooked, and that is the persistence of native cultural identity. Wherever I've gone in the villages, people think of themselves as distinct people in Alaska. They haven't adopted the notion that they're assimilated in any way. Even where they don't speak their languages, they still feel they are distinct people, they belong to a village, that village has certain land and ought to keep that land in perpetuity, pass it on from one generation to the next. And people speak often the corporate language. They talk about shares and profits and proxies, but in the end they often wind up saying, look, what I'm really talking about is the land, and I think this land should stay in native hands in perpetuity. And that, it seems to me, is the bottom line. That's where you keep winding up. Well, 44 million acres is still largely in native hands. What's the best way of ensuring that it remains in native hands? Corporate, IRAs, trusts, something else, or a combination of them. Forgive me, I've talked long enough to bring us to 12 noon, and I think this is
reasonable to begin looking at those motivations and trying to make some policy determination about what can be done to change those shareholder attitudes. I think one of the purposes of these meetings has been to increase the awareness of Native people in Alaska about the importance of 1991. And there have been many corporations that have made efforts to promote shareholder understanding of all the complexities. But even with these efforts, you still have a fairly large number of people that are relatively unaware of what can happen and what they can realistically expect from the corporation over time. One additional point that I would raise is that I think that the time frame, 2011, is a very long run. And I agree with John's worst case scenario, if in fact no changes are made, and if we see sort of many of the negative implications of this scenario taking place, I'd say that that'd probably take place much sooner. And in fact, I think that there is a fair amount of circumstantial evidence to show that that is taking place in terms of the viability of village corporations. And what I'm getting to here is something that was talked about or mentioned earlier on with regard to a statewide Native Corporation Development Corporation that would try to not only blend the interests of the regions but to develop plans and support projects that would be beneficial to the Alaska Native community. And in that regard, I've heard very little about any sort of systemic planning or any of the types of cooperative plans that would promote a more viable development pattern. We've talked a little bit about individual values and the sense of competition and profit that's implicit in the corporate world. Well, you see that evidenced in the competitiveness of regional corporations. At one time, not too long ago, at least 60% of the hotel rooms in the state were owned by Native corporations. Many of the economic activities that are related to supporting the oil economy of the state show that Native corporations compete against each other. And if we're talking about competitiveness and competitive values, one of the ways of perhaps overcoming that would be to look towards cooperative projects that would attempt to support development programs that would maintain a minimum level of livelihood for people that are going to make the decision to remain in the rural parts of the state. And I think that's a very important consideration. In other words, if in fact that one of the principal goals of these proposed resolutions is to maintain Native ownership of the land, then the question that follows is, how are those people out there going to live? Are they going to continue to draw their livelihood from subsistence activities or some combination of subsistence and wage economy? And if it's wage economy, if that's an important component, then how do you promote those kinds of jobs and how do you push that kind of economic development program in the face of declining oil revenues, in the face of declining potential state participation?
Thanks, Gary. Roland Shanks.
Yeah, with fear of dwelling a little bit too much on the doom and gloom side, I think I'd like to run through some numbers that I've been playing with. Just kind of thinking about a fictitious village that might lie near a large metropolitan area in the state where land values are high. Lots typically sell from $40,000 to $50,000 for a residential building lot. This fictitious village might have about 127 members. When you start looking at an entitlement of 100,000 acres of land, which, you know, conservatively is maybe worth $100 million on the books as far as an asset goes, you start looking at an individual asset of the stockholders of about $800,000. You start looking at a price for that share of stock based on that value, which, you know, there's lots of market influences, and maybe they're looking at what they've received in the past as far as income and what they expect to receive in the future as far as income. So maybe you say that the stock value is worth approximately one-fifth of the book value, of the per capita value. And you start looking at the fact that it takes about 65 members to take control of that corporation. And you end up with a final number of about $10 million. To fund, you know, an attempt to take over a corporation like that. Then when you go to the bankers and you lay this whole scenario out for them and you start talking about what kind of leverage they might give you on some money, you start talking about some very low figures to start a scenario like that. As far as there was a lot of talk earlier about who might lead a takeover like that, well, I can think of several leading citizens in Anchorage who might be interested in leading a takeover like that. Especially with an end prize of that size. So I think we are talking about, particularly in some areas of the state, a very real scenario when we start talking about takeovers. There are areas of the states where I don't think that a takeover of village corporations is probably, you know, in the near future. And I think there are areas of the state where the traditional bonds to the land and the traditional bonds to the village center are strong enough that they would turn back any takeover of that sort. But we also have to look at the changing nature of our villages and the fact that youngsters are leaving the villages, that the shares are being dispersed from their original stockholders down through inheritance and death and passing on to new generations, to a broader base of shareholders who have different expectations than some of the original shareholders did.
subsistence purposes? Generally speaking,
I wouldn't, because I know, first of all, Bristol Bay shareholders are for restricted stock, the majority of them. Second of all, Bristol Bay Native Corporation owns so little surface that for me to talk meaningfully about Bristol Bay setting aside anything for subsistence, doesn't make any sense.
I'm talking about the villages. Is what's being suggested here that it's important to maintain restrictions because it's important to maintain subsistence? If Congress then said, we'll accept that as a package, is that a suitable objective?
It might be for the villages, but I don't think it would be for
the
regions.
I'm talking about the villages.
And I'm not from the village. So, Glenn, can you respond to that?
I say restricted. If Congress goes along with restriction, then definitely, I think that's what we're all going for.
Well, Glenn, just to make sure I understand this, the suggestion is that a village corporation whose principal asset is land might seek to have its stock restricted in perpetuity, but that if you had a corporation that had other assets besides land, it would only be as to the ownership of the land that sale of stock would be restricted. That's where I fall off the wagon here, because I don't quite understand how you have some stock restricted and other stock not restricted unless you have two separate corporate entities.
That's what Monroe is suggesting, yeah.
You can have two. I guess that's the point that I was making earlier, is that this is not a sophisticated step to say, take the assets of this is a different conversation than the village corporation, but if you had a corporation that had subsistent land and other assets, real estate in Anchorage, owned the hotel, that you could put the hotel in a corporation, the stock of which is not restricted, and maintain restrictions on the stock which held the lands, the subsistence lands.
And you issue the shares new shares in the new corporation to the
same body of shareholders as hold the restricted stock in the existing ANCSA corporation. Is that
correct? That certainly, it's not the only way, but yeah.
We don't want to do that, though. What I'm saying is, I think the shares of stock that I got, and I bought buildings here in Anchorage. We have apartment buildings, office complexes, and so forth in Anchorage here. With that money, the stock. What I want to do is separate and continue that stock in the old company, the Kuskokwim Corporation, will hold that and move the land to another company, association preferably, and the village people or the shareholders then would have or be members automatically to the land company, land association. Now, the question I would ask people here is this can be done legally, or is there restrictions on it? Or
well, one downside is the one you pointed out, that if you want to open it up for transfers before 1991, it might be hard to say the only transfers you can make are to the tribal government or a cooperative or whatever. It might be said, if this is an act of individual self-determination that you want, people should have the right to transfer to anybody, not just to the tribal group. But Bart, you had suggested earlier, I don't know if it's in your paper, that people might leave their shares by will to the tribal group. And if enough people made wills like that, that would give some indication of what people want to do. That's a form of self-determination. Is that something they can do now, or surely you can leave you write a will now?
That's why I say, yes, we do we have the fear that Congress will open it up to all kinds of things, but I don't see that proposition is any more obtuse than to go to Congress and ask them to stop everyone from alienating stocks. And it's true, as far as I can see, there's nothing that stops people now, elders who are leaving the earth, to leave their stock to whomever they want. They have the absolute right in their stock wills to give it to who they wish, their children, their tribes, whatever.
Yeah,
Claude Dementiev.
I have a question relates to the consolidation or the gathering of shares under one umbrella, such as the corporation, or, well, more specifically, the corporation. Doesn't this allow for an easier hostile takeover for a company to go to the bank and say, look at all these shares, they're all consolidated under one roof now. They're not amongst 5,000 people any longer. It's easy for us to use that as collateral. Here's our down payment. Let's go get it.
When you read some of the shark protections and whatnot, I mean, the inference that I'm making by giving it over to a particularly a tribe is that there is going to be a reluctance on the part of that group to convey. If you can convince them to, then they would have been taken over anyway. I'm thinking that that one of the ways to protect from a takeover is to have a substantial minority or even a majority of stock, and then it's difficult to control. And that group inherently has a better ability to withstand a takeover. Now, let Monroe get in here.
I don't think I fully understand your example, so I can't answer it. And but let me make a couple of points. One of them is that, as we'll see in the AFN resolutions, there is some suggestion that there might be a limited opportunity to have flexibility for the purchase by corporations of individual stock prior to 1991. I think that there are possibly healthy things that could be done prior to 1991. I don't think it's possible that the Native community isn't generally prepared, it's building its own expertise and its own decision making, and I don't know whether it's at the point where it can say these are the things that could be done prior to 1991. But if it were, there could be such things. And one of them is the buyback provision. Just as an example, on the elders problem, one might determine that of all people, elders ought to be able to have some moderate cash in. If you thought anybody would, you might think elders might. You might not. You might not think that's true. You might think that, you may think as a safety valve that individuals who wish to sell a portion, 25% or 30% of the value of their stock ought to be able to do so either before 1991 or after. I mean, that the 1991 date is not an important date there. But it might help to resolve and relieve pressure on the 1991 question if there was a mild and modest door for some people to benefit to some extent. Now, I want to make it clear that, and this gets back to the what I was saying earlier, this doesn't mean that everybody ought to be able to sell or that everybody ought to be able to sell.
Adopted by the
only in the sense, Charlie, that if a decision is one which legally the directors could make on their own,
okay,
it is within the power of the board to decide that they would take an advisory vote or poll of the shareholders in order to assist them in making that decision. They would not normally be thought to be legally bound by such a thing, which is why I called it an advisory vote. Indeed, if you go to areas that may have little relevance to our discussion, normally directors are not supposed to do that. In other words, you're not supposed to elect a director and then have the director constantly be coming back to you and asking, what am I to do, what am I to do, what am I to do? If you think of the pyramid, the whole purpose of having the board was to elect a smaller group that could make decisions and be cohesive, as opposed to having to go to the much larger group and constantly ask for a polling of the situation. Corporations were not Athenian democracies. I mean, only you elected a representative body. So in that sense, the board could go to the shareholders and say, unless three-fourths of you say no, we're proposing to do this. Or they could say, unless 90% of you say no, we're proposing to do this. Those are advisory votes. There are very few areas under which the board would be legally obligated to go to the shareholders.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Could I just, Claude Dementiev and then David Case wanted to get into this. Claude, you go ahead.
As I understand the state law, there's two different votes. There's for the basic changes in the bylaws or the articles of incorporation, more so the bylaws, I believe, it's 50% of a quorum. For extraordinary changes in the corporation, it requires two-thirds, such as liquidation of assets, etc. This resolution here, I'm assuming a lot of things, I'm asking more question, if my assumption is right, that this resolution here allows the Board of Directors to set the vote, circumventing state law, on the minimum number of votes required without even changing their own bylaws. They could set the vote by resolution of a board.
One thing I don't understand, Claude, so I can't really respond until you clarify it on the, if this has been passed, I understand, by the AFN. Is that correct?
Well, no, it hasn't been, according to Charlie.
No, here's a process that we're going through, and hopefully we'll go through a similar process like this and come up with objections like Liz is making before we go ahead and pass these. What we passed at the last convention was that we accepted a process that mandated that management and the leadership of AFN get out to the regions and the villages and go over these resolutions, hopefully making them understood. And out of that will come what will be acceptable to everybody in going to Congress for amendments on ANCSA 1991. And it may very well be that the very point that Liz is raising may be one of the objections, and that may very well not pass AFN. It will be presented to AFN in a different matter that would take care of the objections that might arise, such as the one that Liz is talking about.
Just before we go on, Claude asked a question characterizing this and not seeking to be pejorative. And Dan didn't answer, but Elizabeth, you were nodding in affirmation. Did you agree with Claude's characterization?
Claude, can I repeat it back to make sure I've got it? But as I understood what you were asking, if the thrust of this resolution is put into federal law, Claude has built in the assumption that this resolution were transformed into proper statutory language and built into federal law. Would this not then mean that it would, in effect, preempt the state law standards and perhaps other standards that might be in someone's articles and bylaws? And I was nodding my head that, which, as Tom correctly says, doesn't show up on the tapes, that in general, I think that's a fair statement.
But what happens with this resolution, if it is put into federal law, is that we'll have also the state law to work with. Plus a third now.
Yes.
So a board of directors can operate their options or decisions in either one of three methods.
Well, you would have a problem in trying to decide. The basic and very interesting area is that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act mandates that there be corporations and that they be organized under Alaska state law. Right. And the original vision was that there would be certain federal statutory restrictions on these corporations that would supersede state law that would expire in 1991. Now, it will be an awkward arrangement between state and federal law to figure out how to make these two responsibilities gel if Congress keeps changing, extending, and entering the area while still leaving the basic proposition in place that these are Alaska corporations formed under Alaska law and answerable to Alaska's state legal institutions.
Yeah. Could I just suggest how we proceed here? This is fascinating stuff, but I think where Claude has gotten us is this far, that the resolution, if it were passed, would enlarge the discretion of the Board of Directors, and they could choose to adopt the standard of passage in their articles under relevant state or federal law, or the discretion given to them under the resolution.
I don't think that's correct.
All right.
It is not clear, because of the way resolutions were drafted, and of course, Liz, you were more actively involved in this than I, whether these, whether, when this is finally drafted, it incorporates as an additional limit state law concerning extraordinary acts, that is, or other
of governance. That mean to me that when the Klan leader wasn't able to take care of their Klan members, that Klan leader was replaced with another. The system of governance at, traditionally was that the Klan leaders are the ones that took care of their members, and it wasn't up to a person who was popularly elected by other members of the village or other members of the region, for that matter. So the superimposition of a new structure broke up that decision-making, and it took away the authority of the Klan leaders. And I suspect that that basic principle is true in other regions as well. I'm not as familiar with the Inupiaq region, but I understand that the whaling captains had a lot more say historically over what went on in the village than they currently do, where they do now have some say over the distribution of the wealth that comes with catching a whale. But they don't have the same kind of power that they historically have had over other decision matter, the important decisions of the community. So I do think that it is an important subject for us to address. It does involve the culture, and it does involve the decisions about how assets are to be used and wealth is to be distributed in the communities. Then
you're going on to your new point?
Yes.
I wonder if we could just wrap this up before you do that. And I was using Tony's observations about villages in Southeast families and so on as an illustration. I think Charlie's right, it's a question of numbers and that's life. But my point is, whatever the reason for people selling out in a village, if they sell out to the corporation, they may be in the same position as those people who sold out in the U.S. when were given the right to, when all the reserves were broken up and each person got a piece, and those that sold out were regarded as people who weren't really entitled to continue as members of the tribe by those who had hung on. And it seems to me you've got a very similar situation. Well, I don't want to flog that, but Bart, and then we'll come back to Tony and then Claude.
Just two things, and one relates to that. I agree with Charlie. You're not going to be able to do anything. I mean, in our village, we happen to have four families, but that's the way it is, and that same power structure applies not just to the corporations, but state corporations. It applies to the IRA corporation, and it applied probably before that to the traditional, because even though the leader was thrown out, he was thrown out by the majority, because if the majority didn't want him thrown out, he wouldn't have been thrown out. He didn't throw himself out voluntarily. So the question of who is discriminating, I think, is important. We're not going to be able to do anything about the people in the villages. I think there's one tendency, though, that's beginning, and that is that we ought to stop the federal government from discriminating on the basis of whether you're a shareholder or not. Some recent federal statutes have made that distinction, and I don't think that we should risk the status of a native with the federal government in a special relationship on the basis of whether he owns stock or not and has assets. So that status should be protected, and I think it could be if, when we approach the federal government and ask for this ability to allow us to buy back, that we state specifically in there that even though the person sells, that does not affect his status as an American Indian under federal law. And that should at least stop, to the degree that we can, discrimination, but not discrimination amongst us, but discrimination by the federal government on that basis. The other point I wanted to address is, I understand and I realize the restrictions on alienation, that they are deemed per se unreasonable when they're absolute, and that you usually need, Professor Fessler, a reason that's related to a corporate purpose. I submit that the federal government could make that alienation period absolute, based not on corporate purpose, but on federal plenary power, because ANCSA is Indian legislation. And so I don't think that we really, there may be an issue there, but I think that there is a clear out, at least with regard to absolute alienation of stock in ANCSA corporations due to the special relationship and the federal government's plenary power over Indians.
Maybe we could Just have Claude, do you want to add anything, and then we'll come to Tony?
Just an observation. I think my question was answered, but right now we do have two classes of natives already, those born before 1971 and those born after. I think it needs to be not discussed just here, but statewide by all corporations, just what are the destructive elements, if any, of that situation. ANCSA legislates the removal of the restrictions on the stock after 1991, which will increase the separation of the two different natives, shareholders, non-shareholder. I can imagine going home and saying, oh, hello, how are you doing? Haven't seen you in a long time. Are you a shareholder? I'm a shareholder. People are going to be talking about that type of situation. Nobody's really looked at what destructive elements, if any, can come about because of that situation. If you want to have the corporations buy the stock, you can do that after 1991 according to the law, but maybe in the interim there are other things that can be done. If the intent of the resolution is to provide for the elders, for example, to give them something before 1991, which is an honorable
asked of this question before, but it's not a part of the discussion yet, is what about those older natives who would be new natives had they registered to become shareholders, but by some reason they didn't register. They're natives, or they meet the blood quantum requirements, and somehow they didn't get registered by 1972 or 73 when the cutoff date was. They're not participants in the Claim Settlement Act, and these resolutions don't address that. And I was wondering if there was going to be some method for getting those people to become shareholders.
Yeah, in our discussions on this particular resolution 04, there were three classes of people, or I guess we can call them classes of natives, I guess now. Those that were born after 1971, those that did not register for some reason, no matter what reason, and elders. And the intention was here to include those three groups of natives that we felt needed to be, and everybody has felt needed to be included in the land claims benefits.
Thank you. Bart?
Yes, yeah, just a couple of questions and pointing out some things. I don't like ringing my own bell, but this discussion, the conflict that you're having here then is whether we want to continue with the typical kind of distribution of assets under a corporate system with private property rights as the basis, versus how much, you know, that conflicts with our idea of sharing the assets and distributing out to everyone. I don't think that we ought to look at it. I mean, we can say that we'll have either or. We'll either have pure distribution or under corporate law, private property, or else we're going to spread it out to everyone. There are places in between, and what we're talking about is what kind of different distribution systems can we have so that we all participate and still feel like a community. I mean, Professor Fessler and some other corporate people may be able to talk about the idea of making different classes of stock so that, well, right now under corporate law you've got preferred and common shares. You could make all original issue stock preferred, give them a right to a certain guaranteed distribution, because the problem you have is that over time you have the diminishing value of your share because of the increasing number of people. And then new people who come in, or else a second class of stock, you could call it common stock or whatnot, gets a certain set percentage of what's left of whatever distributions you have after that. I mean, that's somewhere in the middle, so that you guarantee the first body a guaranteed return, and they can go ahead and distribute that out to their kids and whatnot, however they want it, because it always remains preferred stock. And yet you could still stop everyone from being able to alienate it if you want, because that's the problem that we have that we're talking about, with individuals being able to replace themselves with non-natives or people who we don't want to. The other question I have, in discussing the elders resolution, was it intended, I know that, and there's no, I don't want to upset anyone, but was the idea of the elders, the body of people who existed in 1971, or the idea of elders as an ongoing thing where we will make it a permanent idea that we always do respect elders today as well in 2000? Because, I mean, if you'll forgive me, there will be some people who become older in 1990, who may not exactly be our idea of traditional kind of elders, but they will be, you know, the very successful corporate folks who have a nice pension. And if we want to make this a permanent distribution system, or if we're talking about a, you know, honoring those people who we thought of as traditional elders who existed at a time because they haven't been able to benefit from the act, because in the first 20 years we haven't made money, and they're going to die before they get anything. Could you? Is it an ongoing thing we're talking about, or that's a possibility, I suppose, permanent change in the distribution system?
Well, I think that the intention here was that elders will always be with us, and those of you that will grow older will benefit someday, or those of us, I should say, huh? And that we'll always have that our elders with us, and that we'll be able to provide for their needs at some point. Ironically, or I don't know whether it's ironic or not, you know, the benefits of the Land Claims Act really have fallen to only a few. And that few are those of us that are employed by the corporations. The primary economic benefit has been to those that have been employed by the corporations, and it has not fallen to the general native population. And
to that history, to use the corporation as the vehicle for the Alaska settlement, and then to say that shares were alienable, and indeed the peculiarities were going to be taken off after 20 years, that involved a congressional decision that after 20 years the corporation would have served as a vehicle wherein people would have entered the world with these assets and with a machinery in place, and that all prior history about the prerogative of Congress to change its mind and whether individuals have acquired status as opposed to their historic tribes, et cetera, that all of those things would be caught in jeopardy on the day that question is posed in that form, and whether we could be very confident of the outcome.
Well, my view is that that we could be confident of the outcome. The Supreme Court in recent years has taken the position, without reference to Indians, but with reference to what they call future anticipatory benefits from a transaction, business benefits that you will get. And I comment on the Allard, who owned this marvelous collection of eagle feathers, and was told a few years ago that his feathers were worth nothing. He could look at them, but he couldn't do anything with them because he can't sell them. Well, instantly his inventory went from hundreds of thousands of dollars worth down to zero, and the Supreme Court said that's too bad because those are not future, those are not present benefits, that's something you would have earned in the future. It looks very much like stock ownership in ANCSA. Secondly, if you look at the Menominee termination, the Menominee tribe individually held stock in a state-chartered and state-organized corporation, and that was, the land was taken out of that status and put back into trust status. There has been no judicial determination of that. There was a lower court case that was started and then dropped for various reasons. But even more than that is the so-called plenary power of Congress, which has been demonstrated so many times and so powerfully in Indian affairs. And whether for right, for just, for injustice, or whatever, that power of Congress is very, very strong, and I think would be sufficient basis if Congress decided to change its mind on the ground that this is for the benefit of the natives. It may be right, it may be wrong, but the Supreme Court has said we won't look behind Congress's statement that this is for the benefit of the natives. And if that's true, why then Congress could change the rules of the game, especially with regard to something that hasn't yet come to fruition. It'll come to fruition in 1991 or something, and is still speculative, and can do so without violating the Constitution. Now, that doesn't answer the question of the political advisability, and I think there's a lot of issue about that, and I don't think Congress is going to act on the basis of just why, because it's constitutional. They're going to listen to Elizabeth Johnson and Roland Shanks and Glenn Fredericks and a lot of these people about what is this, what's the intelligent thing to do. But I think as far as constitutional power, let me add another thing. There's going to be somebody who's going to sue anyway. I don't think you can go around the world deciding you're going to try and not have a lawsuit because you're going to be sued. But I think that Congress is going to have to figure out the odds on it and go ahead and do what seems to be the just and right thing to do.
Elizabeth, then Bart, and then Claude.
I think certainly the different perspectives on this issue have been laid out, and I won't go back and I hope reiterate anything I've said before. I merely wanted to add slightly to what Roland said, which is, and again, I recognize this is a policy perspective, not a legal one. I am somewhat concerned also about going into Congress and saying that Congress has the power to do anything it wants. Again, Professor Johnson's memory on this is even better than mine, but my memory is that Congress has not always acted in a beneficent manner toward Native populations, and has sometimes changed around things that have meant that the Native population got the short end of the stick and that some other group tended to benefit. I tend to think that the pressures on wishing to reach certain lands and certain assets in the state of Alaska are going to increase, not decrease, and therefore that the motivations for a well-financed effort will increase, and even pressures on the political institutions will increase to do these things. And I would prefer not to be, perhaps in the future, in a posture of having established a principle that Congress can take and change corporate assets and move them into different kinds of status, trust or otherwise. And I would rather not be in a position of having argued that individual shareholders do not have vested rights, because I think that pathway leads me to dig problems for the shareholders who I'm supposed to be trying to protect and the corporation which I'm supposed to be trying to represent. I tend to find more protection in the long run in vested rights and would rather take care of them and pay deference to them than I would create the other problem later, which I believe Roland gave a very nice concrete example of.
Bart Garber?
I guess I speak more in this situation rather than as an attorney. I can put that away as being a Native who may get stuck in that position of having to make that policy decision of what to do about the dissenters. And I find some support in that it is a historically a political decision, and that the same kinds of things faced Congress and the federal executive before, Ralph, as you know, with the termination of allotment policy in the 30s, when lots of individual Natives down in the states had their own little blocks of land, and Congress had the choice, and the administration had the choice in trying to draft up the Indian Reorganization Act, when they tried taking all of those lands and putting them back together again and making them communal holdings instead of individual. They got all kinds of static from Natives, both kinds, both, you know, acculturated ones who wanted to keep the property because they wanted to subdivide it. And surprisingly, they also had the static from the traditional ones who thought that they had held this land for 50 or 60 years for the tribe and they weren't going to have the federal government, who they didn't trust, suddenly tell them that they were going to take the land back and we'll protect you. And they kind of said, well, they shook their head and said, well, so there was static on both sides. The point is that it was a political decision, and even though there may have been a court case afterward, in that instance, the administration opted to make the choice of the Native to give his property over a voluntary one, and they didn't force them to. You may come out with any number of alternatives. I have one other. I've been kind of concerned about dissenters' rights myself, and I would like to preserve them, or at least try to find a way to preserve them for another reason, and that is that we have to, and this takes into, in part, you know, something of a traditional philosophy also, that Natives resolve their disputes to remain harmonious, to be able to continue on afterward. What happens when you do have a large percentage of your people upset, whether they happen to be the kind who want to have private property rights, or perhaps in an individual instance you've got a substantial minority of more traditional folk? It doesn't matter. You're going to have
One of the things you did list was how do we immunize the lands from corporate failure, and in my view, obviously you need a combination of things to do that. One thing standing alone won't do it. But perhaps the combination of the restricted stock together with this possible improvement suggested by Don Mitchell and the land bank would provide that protection, even within the corporate format.
Well, just pursuing the thought for a moment,
restricting sale of stock means that the native corporation won't be taken over. Putting the native corporation's land in the land bank means it's immunized from taxation as long as it's used for subsistence or undeveloped. But if the corporation fails, then the creditors get the land in the land bank, or is the thrust of this proposal that it never comes out? What could you explain that?
I don't think the thrust of the AFN proposal is that it never could come out. I think you could, because I think, as my understanding was, that they left with the board of directors the discretion to pull out. But what it left unanswered, just because of the way the land bank was drafted, and because, as I understand it, how bankruptcy law is drafted, that they didn't mesh very well, and you have that hole in the legislation where it's possible to argue that as the creditors move in and their interests are represented by the trustee in bankruptcy, that he could then have the discretion, which he has instead then of the board of directors, would have the discretion to take the land out and use it to satisfy debts, which of course cuts against the whole intention.
But right now, if you did happen to get some land into the land bank, leave this AFN resolution out of it, if you got land in the land bank now, the Anilka land bank, it would be immune from taxation while it's in the land bank. But when the 10 years, but if your corporation failed, and leaving Mitchell's gap out of it, let's assume there is no gap, as when the 10 years expires, then the creditor can take the land. Is that it?
Well, if I were on the board of directors and I was approaching the 10-year period, I would make sure nothing expired. I would just slap the 5 years on top of it.
Well, under the law as it stands now, when you've slapped your 5 years on top, is that the end?
No, you can keep going. Am I saying it's good, Will? Both Roland and Glenn, who are agreeing with me, that the extension, although it's for a term, you can add terms.
Do you want to speak into the mic, Roland? Roland Shanks?
I said the real question would probably be whether there's a positive motion needed to maintain the land in the land bank, and if you'd already had a takeover or a bankruptcy situation or something like that, the corporation may be unable to make that positive move to keep it in the land bank.
You mean that if your corporation goes into bankruptcy and the trustee in bankruptcy is running the corporation, he isn't going to renew the land bank?
Might be. I would guess that.
It might be a breach of his duties to the creditors, one would think.
There's also a couple other problems that have come up in context with the land bank. One is, and I think that this has pretty much been resolved, but early on there appeared to be maybe a states' rights issue brewing with the federal government essentially usurping taxing authority of the state of Alaska and adverse possession and some of these other things which the state has held very dear as being state issues. I think that's been turned back. I think the state has now seen that this is a good thing. But it is a problem that could come up again in the future. There's a potential that there's going to be a state version of the land bank introduced in next year's legislature, which will not only offer a state version, but will affirm the federal version to take care of any.
And I, as a citizen of the United States, would go against that.
Yes.
What we ought to be, and that's why I'm saying how to protect this land. Maybe what we ought to be talking about is dealing with the federal government before it goes to court on these sovereignty questions. I mean, we have 200 little villages out there going to be a nation. Now, the state of Alaska cannot, and the United States cannot, in my mind, deal with this. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm from Georgetown, a little village of 35 people. If I have a sovereign right, I can say to you, you can't come into my, I'm a sovereign nation. Well, that's asinine, you know. That is absolutely asinine to me. That, until that question is dealt with, and clarified from Congress or from the courts, I'd be very hesitant to put my land into an IRA for that reason, because Congress can pull that thing down on you, and what do you have? Nothing.
How do you feel about IRAs, Professor Fessler?
Well, I'll give you an idea of how stupid I was. For the first five times I heard that, I thought you meant those individual retirement accounts. And there is a sense in which that's exactly what you mean, only you're arriving at it through a very different mechanism. Now, I don't know enough about Indian Reorganization Act to begin.
I thought that, in fact, we would come to that tomorrow. It's getting on toward 4, and I'd like to carry on this discussion this afternoon for a little while and then tomorrow, because I think it really is the guts of what everybody's concerned about. Rosemary Maher, and then Bart, and then Roland.
The two resolutions, 8407 and 8408, they refer to IRAs. There are not that many IRAs in the state of Alaska. And I don't know what, if the state recognizes traditional village councils or not. Does anybody have an answer to that?
Bart?
They deal with them, and they've actually written them into their regulations and whatnot. So, I mean, they recognize that the federal entity exists. They question sometimes the scope of its powers or the underlying common law that applies to it. Pardon me? Yeah, they've taken contracts with them, and there have been court cases that say they have immunity, or that some others don't, because they're not an IRA, or they don't have immunities in certain business transactions.
Could I just say something, Rosemary? At this roundtable, we're struggling with 1991 and protecting the land and so on. We're having a roundtable in December to discuss IRAs and sovereignty, because they're necessarily part of this thing, and it seems to me you can't discuss one without discussing the other. So I am more interested right at the moment in the attributes of IRAs as vehicles for holding land than I am about sovereignty itself. That's something we'll come to next month. But I know they're mingled, and you can't talk about one without talking about the other. But I think it's useful, while we've got these people here, to look at co-ops and nonprofits and IRAs. And I should add that this commission has been looking at any number of alternatives developed in other countries, because the list isn't just co-ops, profits and IRAs. But I interrupted you. You go ahead.
Well, most villages that are not organized under the IRAs do have traditional village councils. And I was curious to know what the problem would be with putting traditional village councils on this list that they have of nonprofit or IRA.
David Case? Oh, and then Drew?
They are on the list. I mean, do you mean the federal list of recognized?
This
resolution.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm not sure. Maybe then Marlene should answer.
There is no problem with it. It says IRA, nonprofit, or other entity. And IRA just is a common used thing in Alaska, and that's one of the major, and there are quite a number of IRAs in the state of Alaska. Was used, but we don't. It may be a new entity that hasn't even been dreamed up yet.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is because they've stopped any IRAs until the issues are settled between the federal and the state government. So there may be some time before any new IRAs are issued.
So in the meantime, the traditional council should serve. Is that the point?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
David Case?
What was the question, the point you just made just then? It was getting confusing.
Yeah, Drew Hageman. Well, I just said that, look, traditional councils are on this list of Marlene's, that's all.
I see. Okay. I think that should be made, too, about traditional councils and IRAs, I mean, the distinction, if any, between the two, which seems to me to be, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, that seems to me to be what you're asking. Is that correct?
No, I was just curious to why they weren't included in these two resolutions.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry.
They mention IRAs, but they don't mention traditional village councils.
One of the...
And she kind of explained it.
Perhaps one of the difficulties with traditional councils is that they don't exist on paper. And so when it comes to a paper-oriented society and court system, looking at these institutions and trying to figure out what they are, do they exist, what powers do they have, you may run into the difficulty that there's nothing on paper that sort of